Everybody.
We will proceed, please. Williams versus Davis.
May it please the court, counsel. At the outset, before delving into the merits of the case, I want to address two errors that were not brought to the attention of the courts in briefing. First, with respect to petitioner's lead brief at page 12, the third full paragraph, last line. It reads, parenthetically, counsel for petitioner did not cross-examine the state's expert about the blood found on petitioner's shorts. I'd like to correct that. In fact, counsel on recross examination did ask one single question about the blood evidence, that transcript page 1738. But quite frankly, this question does not address the issues that petitioner now raises with respect to the blood evidence. And the other correction, I'd like to direct your attention to petitioner's brief at page 29, the last paragraph, the first parenthetical point, which reads, a blood spatter expert determined that the blood Epperson found on petitioner's shorts was inconsistent with blood from a shooting. And instead, that language should mirror the language that appears on page 28 on the second full paragraph, parenthetical 6. Expert evaluation of the blood on petitioner's shorts did not indicate he was the shooter. And with those corrections, I'd like to move on to the merits of petitioner's claim.
Please proceed.
We have raised two claims on appeal, and they are inextricably intertwined in that they both involve ineffective assistance of counsel claims. The only question in this case is whether or not the petitioner was prejudiced by counsel's deficient performance. The parties all agree that counsel's performance was deficient. In briefing in the Indiana Supreme Court, the Attorney General acknowledged deficient performance. They were also asked in oral arguments in the Indiana Supreme Court whether they conceded prejudice, and the Attorney General so acknowledged. So the only question here is whether or not Williams was prejudiced, and he was, because this was a very close case. Both the jury, it was a hard decision for the jury, and the judge in this case originally was going to spare petitioner the death penalty and only sentence him to a term of years. So in looking at the prejudice, this is a very, very close case. With respect to the district court's findings on the blood issue, the district court found that the Indiana Supreme Court factually erred and found additional facts that were favorable to the petitioner.
Could I just ask you, though, suppose you're right, and it's a close case on prejudice. Doesn't the standard of review under the Anti-Terrorism Act mean that that's exactly the kind of case in which it's our obligation to defer to the Indiana, you know, the final result in Indiana, which is now the Indiana Supreme Court, if it's that close?
Well, there are two reasons why the Indiana Supreme Court's decision was erroneous in this case. First of all, they had a finding, their findings of fact were erroneous, and that actually the district court made a finding that the Indiana Supreme Court's factual findings were incomplete.
Isn't that the first time around for the Indiana Supreme Court?
No, that's the second time around for the Indiana Supreme Court. Well, they originally had factual errors in the original direct appeal opinion, but then second of all, District Court Judge Sharp, in his opinion at page 868, he finds that there was certainly a great deal more evidence presented at post-conviction than was presented to the jury. And the Indiana Supreme Court had found that the evidence raised at post-conviction was essentially the same as what had been presented to the jury. And in making this finding, Judge Sharp basically listed out three things that Williams' jury did not know that were significant. First was that at the time petitioner was brought to the Gary police station, he was examined by crime lab technicians and by police officers. They were looking for blood. They were looking for brain matter. They found none. The second point was that there was an opportunity for the contamination of petitioner's shorts because he was allowed to wear this clothing in the Gary City Jail for 2 days before he was shipped to the Lake County Jail. That's the point where his
What difference does that make? Does the blood change within 48 hours on clothing?
Well, there was no blood originally seen at all.
Yes,
and then
but
there was
then
an
after there was.
There was an opportunity for contamination during that time period. That's the significance of the fact that he was in the Gary City Jail for those couple of days. There was another.
Do you have any case that says that blood changes on clothing within 48 hours?
I do not.
There aren't any, are there?
Not that I'm aware of. What I can tell you, though, is that one of the crime lab technicians who was there at the Gary City jail and who examined the clothing said, look, I looked carefully and I saw nothing. He then was...
So you're saying that blood was introduced at the jail somehow?
That's definitely a possibility. So from
off the bodies of the other people?
Or from any other source. I mean, what we know about this blood evidence is that it was consistent with 45%
of
the population. 45% of
the population, that's what you've argued.
That's right. And what this crime lab technician, Ronald Black, testified to is he said, you know, as a crime lab tech, it didn't seem to him that the location of this blood would have been blood that would have come from a crime scene. That's the testimony that he gives at post-conviction, and that can be found at page... Pardon me.
Don't waste your time. I'm just going
to... But in any event, that's an argument that certainly could have been made to the jury. And at post-conviction, the lawyers for Williams testified that had they been aware that there was no blood originally seen on him and then he was at the jail wearing these clothing at this time, they would have made the argument that there's a possibility that the clothing was contaminated with blood from a different source at the jail. And then thirdly... the other point that Judge Sharp mentions in his opinion as information the jury didn't have in assessing the significance of the blood evidence is that when the clothing was taken to the crime lab for forensic analysis, it was brought in a plastic bag, and it was the policy of that crime lab not to accept for forensic analysis items brought in a plastic bag. And the reason is because there's a possibility for degradation.
But I don't see an argument in these briefs that there was something wrong with the analysis of the blood itself. In other words, the sample wasn't good enough to conduct a reliable analysis. So even though I understand the theoretical possibility of degradation from plastic, it seems that not enough had happened here to prevent testing of the blood, wherever this blood may have come from. You know, I recognize that as a different point.
Well, the significance of the degradation is this. In this case, DNA testing was not available yet. So what the serologist did was tested these 10 blood standards. It's the ABO standard and then various other enzymes. And in doing that testing, she was only able to make it a match. She was only able to determine 2 of the 10 standards. And those 2 of the 10 standards weren't enough to, you know, exclude the victim's blood as being the blood on Defendant Williams. But had the blood not been degradated, perhaps if they had been
you
able to get more standards...
You suspect that it was degraded.
We suspect.
That's your argument.
That's correct. That's correct. If it had been properly packaged, there's a possibility that perhaps the victims could have been excluded as the donors of the blood if there had been a more, you know, better preserved sample available.
But let me ask you, pardon me.
Please.
Weren't there 6 other witnesses who placed Williams in the house during the shooting, several of whom heard him discuss it and argue with the people who were deceased?
The evidence regarding Williams is as follows. He was there.
Well, just answer me yes or no. Isn't that a fact?
The fact, as far as my review of the record, is that he was outside at the time the shooting occurred and that there were no eyewitnesses to the actual shooting.
No, that's not what I asked you. I asked you, weren't there 6 witnesses who placed Williams inside the house during the shooting, several of whom heard him discuss the shooting or argue with the Reeses, the people who he offed?
There was testimony that he was in the house at some point in the evening, but when the...
During the shooting.
During the shooting, there's nobody that testifies that he's inside the house. They're testifying that they don't see him.
It said, and that they heard him.
He was...
They heard him discuss it.
There's one witness, Derek Bryan, who testified for the state. That's the only witness who testifies that he hears Petitioner having any sort of involvement with the Reeses. The other witnesses just talk about him, you know, going in and out of the house at various points in time. As far as I understand the evidence to be. And there's no eyewitness to the actual killing itself.
Well, again, I want to get back to the standard of review, because if, in fact, the Indiana Supreme Court had this additional evidence in front of it that was developed in post-conviction proceedings, and if it evaluated this additional evidence that you've now gone through as not being compelling enough to make a difference, whether it sort of offhandedly calls it, you know, pretty much the same thing or what have you, it does have it in front of it. In the end, the Indiana Supreme Court thinks that this is not enough to show Strickland prejudice. And I'm concerned that if that's its conclusion, aren't you asking us simply just to reweigh this evidence? You know, Judge Sharp understands that it's there, too, and it's different, but it doesn't seem as though the trial judge originally is relying all that much on the blood evidence anyway in his sentencing decision.
My response to that would be twofold. First of all, the blood evidence was critical in the sentencing decision in this case. The main question at sentencing was who was the trigger man, who was the shooter, and co-defendant Rouster.
Death penalty, right?
They did, but co-defendant Rouster took the position that because there was no other evidence specifically putting the petitioner in the room where the killings happened, except for this blood evidence, and the co-defendant Rouster took the position that this blood evidence was the key point saying that Williams was the shooter, and the state did not even take that position in this case. In this case, interestingly enough, the state said, we can't tell you who shot or who did what, because they knew the evidence couldn't support it. But the co-defendant took it one step further. And in doing so, the trial judge relied on that in his findings. You'll see that Judge James Lexinger found that the location of the blood evidence was significant. And then again, the Indiana Supreme Court relied upon that in its original review of this case. So the blood evidence was actually the most significant evidence, I believe, in having him sentenced to death. But also, back to the Indiana Supreme Court's decision, the Indiana Supreme Court, the district court, I'm sorry, looked at the Indiana Supreme Court opinion and felt that the Indiana Supreme Court had not fairly treated the new evidence relating to the blood, and that's why he made a point of saying that he disagreed with the Indiana Supreme Court and actually found there was certainly a great deal more presented and then detailed that evidence, and that's at page 868. But coming back to the legal standard employed by the Indiana Supreme Court in this case clearly applied Fretwell. There's two places in its opinion where they discuss Fretwell. The very first place is at page 154, where they lay out their standard for reviewing ineffective assistance of counsel claims.
So why does that matter? Because the way they set it up, I'm looking at the same thing you are. They say even if the claimant succeeds in showing a reasonable probability the results would have been different, which you would agree is the Strickland standard, he has to do even more. However, they find he doesn't do the first thing. So they never ask him to do the Lockwell.
I would respectfully disagree with that characterization, going to page 156 of the Indiana Supreme Court's decision where they actually discuss do their prejudice analysis. This is what they say. Quote, counsel's arguments to the jury, coupled with the above factual testimony, rendered Williams' trial a reliable adversarial testing process.
Now, that's Strickland.
That's Fretwell language, not Strickland language.
But they cite Strickland, a particular page.
They do say that, but I've looked back again through Strickland, through Fretwell, and then also through the Terry Williams opinion issued by the United States Supreme Court in 2000, and this, looking for whether or not it's a reliable adversarial testing process, is actually a Lockhart versus Fretwell analysis rather than a Strickland analysis. Strickland requires looking at whether or not the result would have been different.
And the whole paragraph you just read is the Indiana Supreme Court saying it thinks it wouldn't have been. They would have been unable to provide the jury with any information significantly different. The evidence wouldn't have significantly changed the facts. Williams was not prejudiced. I mean, again, I'm certainly prepared to, you know, I understand your argument that this may be an erroneous conclusion, but they seem to be saying they don't think the result would be different.
You know, it's my reading of it that they were applying Lockhart versus Fretwell. There's no Strickland language whatsoever in this paragraph.
Didn't Judge Sharp find they applied Strickland?
He did, and in doing so, though, he didn't really give us any guidance onto why he reached that conclusion. He only cited page 154, this initial paragraph where they set forth the Strickland standard, and actually even in doing so, he doesn't even acknowledge the fact that Lockhart versus Fretwell is added on as an additional requirement. And then he does not even give us any insights into why he reached his decision about how they treat the actual issue at page 156.
Nevertheless, he found they applied Strickland.
He did. He did. And and we believe that Judge Sharp erred in two ways in this case. First, in finding that the Indiana Supreme Court properly applied Strickland, and we believe that they did apply Fretwell. And as a caveat, around this same time, this was before the U.S. Supreme Court had come out with its decision in Terry Williams, the Indiana Supreme Court was routinely applying Lockhart versus Fretwell in other cases. For example, in the case of Alton Coleman, another capital case, the Indiana Supreme Court had required him to also show Lockhart versus Fretwell prejudice And Mr. Coleman took that matter to the United States Supreme Court on a writ of certiorari, and it was granted, reversed, and remanded for reconsideration in light of the fact that the inappropriate standard was applied. But the other manner in which we believe Judge Sharp erred was simply in, after finding that the Indiana Supreme Court had ignored facts favorable to petitioner, that he did not then grant relief under his de novo review of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The Indiana Supreme Court, in its decision, found that the arguments of counsel alone were sufficient to render, to protect the defendant's constitutional rights. And I just want to remind this court, that argument was delivered by an attorney who admittedly did not even read any of the discovery whatsoever in this case.
Do you realize that you're into your rebuttal time?
I did not.
Well, you have your paper covering the light, that's why.
Thank you for bringing that to my attention. Well, with that in mind, then, I'll like reserve the remainder of the time for rebuttal with the... Thanks.
All right.
May it please the court. The Indiana Supreme Court and the District Court properly analyzed defendant's ineffective assistance and severance claims and properly denied him relief on these claims because, simply, he does not meet the Strickland standard for prejudice in any of his arguments. First, I would like to point out one error in defendant's argument that the trial court was going to sentence Mr. Williams to a term of years. And there's only one thing in the record, and as far as my review of the case shows, habeas is the first time that has ever been asserted, is a form sentencing worksheet, basically, that the judge filled out with Mr. Williams' name on the top. And if he was going to sentence him to a term of years, he would have used that sheet. And that sheet found its way, I believe, into the post-conviction record, maybe in the direct appeal record. But that is the only indication. There was no statement by the trial judge that would have sentenced Williams to a term of years, but for Rouster's or the state's argument. All indications showed that Judge Letzinger was going to
Well, this is Williams' case, not Rouster, right?
I'm sorry?
I said this is Williams' case, not Rouster. We've done Rouster.
Yes. But there's no indication that Judge Letzinger was going to do, if I misspoke, I apologize.
No, you just said the wrong name. Okay.
There's no indication that Judge Letzinger was going to do anything but properly weigh the jury's recommendation and the aggravating and the mitigating circumstances and come to an independent conclusion after sentencing. That is exactly
what worries me about this case, Mr. Creason. First of all, throughout, you know, the facts seem to have been dealt with in a very sloppy way by the court. So the first Indiana Supreme Court decision is riddled with factual mistakes, which the state courts then begin correcting later on. And, you know, I'm perfectly prepared to say that you need to let the entire state process run its course before you see which facts the state courts have finally settled on, but things like, you know, who's where and where's the blood and what's in the bag and who's, you know, just all kinds of things seem to be in error. And that leads me to my concern about the way this blood evidence is treated, since focusing on the effectiveness of counsel, it does strike me as it's quite unrealistic, very unrealistic, to say that this was not absolutely crucial evidence placing Mr. Williams in the room at the time the murder is committed.
obviously felony murder doesn't require that, but at the sentencing stage, I'm not really focusing so much on the conviction. What I'm worried about is the possibility of prejudice at sentencing. Maybe you could address that.
First, I do acknowledge that errors were made in factual findings on direct appeal, and the Indiana Supreme Court acknowledged that in the post-conviction appeal,
right.
Regretted its mistake, and indicated it didn't make a difference because it wasn't that important.
Counsel, we're asking you to focus on what she asked you about, because I'm concerned too.
The evidence in this case, the blood evidence and who was where and all this, it was extremely confusing. The trial judge himself got mixed up several times.
Evidence, not confusing.
The evidence is not particularly, in my opinion, compelling, showing defendant's presence at the crime. First of all, the jury knew
it
that
isn't.
Not in my opinion, Your Honor.
But didn't the state...
That he doesn't have to be at the scene of the crime?
The blood evidence is not particularly compelling that it was the blood of the victim. This is the evidence.
Could you just... I mean, the way the evidence is used, I think we all know what the evidence is. Certainly Judge Caney's been through this case in one form or another a couple of times. But it was my understanding, I don't know whether it was you or another of your colleagues, that the state attorney made some point of this at the trial, called it to the attention, and at a capital sentencing phase, it really does make a difference. I mean, everything makes a difference, of course, at that stage. And if you're there in the room and the victim, and potentially the victim's blood is splattered on you, it's a different case than if you're standing out front, or if you're possibly even in the next room.
That is true, Your Honor. However, there's very little evidence showing that this was even the victim's blood. The evidence technician testified at trial that 45% of the world's population, this blood matched.
And didn't the state's attorney reply, yes, but only the Reeses were in the room at that time, or words to that effect?
For the third time,
yes.
Please give us some information from your point of view as how you established that he was in the room.
There are 30 caliber bullets were found in the doorway to the room that were found on his person. They matched the same brand. They were the only 30 caliber bullets involved in this case. And they could not have been used in either of the guns, and the jury knew that.
They couldn't have been used in either of the guns?
That is correct.
But it was still his gun? That's what you just said.
No, I'm sorry if I was not clear. The guns that were used were a .22 caliber and a .32 caliber.
Right.
30 caliber bullets were found in the doorway to the room, where an ear witness heard defendant testify.
Right.
Order, it's your time. Get on the floor. Mr. Williams was actively involved in pushing Mr. Rouster to do the robbery. Mr. Rouster, it was his money.
How do you know that? That's what we're asking to see.
Because Derek Bryant, the ear witness, heard and actually, I believe, saw petitioner outside the house saying, I quote, "I won't let her. She's not doing nothing but jipping you out of your money." And then Rouster, according to that, made his decision. I'm going to go rob them. And he had a gun in on his back. Either in his waistband or in his, there's a witness saying they saw a gun on his pocket or in his waistband, and they headed in. There are witnesses that saw defendant go in and out of the house. There's witnesses that saw him looking for my shells, which presumably could be the 30 caliber bullets or any other number of things. There were two guns used here.
But not a 30 caliber gun.
Not a 30 caliber gun. But why would Mr. Rouster or anyone else you use two guns to kill two different people? The evidence gives the strong inference that one of them killed one and the other one killed the other. One with Mrs. Reese's gun and the other with the gun that Rouster brought to the crime. That is a reasonable reading of the evidence.
Did I understand you to say there was a 30 caliber slug found in the wood around the door?
No, they were live bullets, not discharged, found on the doorway, on the floor, to the doorway to the bedroom. The individual who heard all of this knew petitioner and Rouster and everyone involved fairly well. He knew their voices. Also, it is important to note that the last shots fired, Rouster and his girlfriend and petitioner's sister, Newsom, were outside in the driveway after having just distracted the police and sent them down the street. Then more shots were fired. Petitioner had been seen entering the house and had never been seen leaving the house. Everyone else had left. The Edwin Taylor, or the other co-defendant, had left. But the four people that were there, two were outside, one had left, and Petitioner was last seen going inside when the last shots were fired. Whether or not the blood...
Is this the time that corresponds to this Streeter testimony that we were also told about?
The Streeter testimony is inconsistent with everyone else's testimony at trial.
That happens, as you know. I mean,
certainly.
Sometimes can affect outcomes, too.
Certainly. It's also been defaulted. It was never presented to the Indiana Supreme Court. The petitioner cannot rely on it now, realizing that his evidence at the Indiana Supreme Court wasn't good enough and presenting this court with new arguments.
Of course, if it were strong evidence of actual innocence, that wouldn't be true. The Supreme Court has an exception for that. We don't execute people who we now know are actually innocent.
Yes. And
did anyone hear Williams say, it's now your time? And then this man, Brewster, said, now waste them?
I'm not familiar with the now waste them comment. There were so
Isn't
many...
there testimony from Bryant to that effect?
There's testimony to Bryant that petitioner said, it's your time, and then shots were fired. Or after Henrietta pled for her life at the hands of Greg Rouster.
And previously pled for her husband?
Yes.
And said he has heart trouble?
Yes. And petitioner said, his heart's stronger than mine. And then they brought him back. Somebody was thrown against the wall. There were victims against the wall in this case, as the photographs submitted at trial show. Petitioner was at the scene. He was actively involved in the murders. Even
those
are
conclusions. Give us the facts.
Those facts show, that we discussed, show he was at the scene. There was testimony he was at the scene. The blood evidence, whatever the import of that, perhaps corroborates it, but not entirely.
Well, see, when you say at the scene, what bothers me, again, I really don't want to focus right now on whether he was guilty of murder as a conviction point, because it seems to me the evidence you've described, Indiana Supreme Court very reasonably could have considered that to be the case. But in terms of the question whether he had done something that was so heinous as to deserve capital punishment, whether he's in the next room at the time Rouster is brutally murdering these two people, or whether he's in there pulling the trigger, can make a difference in capital sentencing proceedings. And if there are blood splatters on him, that is extremely powerful indication that he's right there in the middle of the murdering, whereas if he's just in and out of the house and egging Rouster on and doing all the other things that you just described, it looks like a different case. And when we're trying to evaluate this prejudice aspect of Strickland, once we've decided the performance was inadequate, I'm hard-pressed to see why placing you in the room with the blood evidence isn't something that would have created a reasonable probability that the sentence would have been different. It doesn't have to be a certainty. You don't have to come up to some percentage level. You just have to have your confidence undermined in the result.
The blood evidence presented at PCR, the Indiana Supreme Court correctly found, was not substantially different from that which was discussed at trial. The 45% of the world's population was said. The evidence technician testified he didn't see any blood on petitioner's shorts. And that was before Kimberly Epperson, the serologist, testified she did find blood on the shorts. The post-conviction court, the trial judge on post-conviction, on the record explains, and I don't have a record site for it, it discusses what petitioner shorts look like, that they were dark with a purple or blue with a wine-colored geometric design, that it would be extremely difficult to see were very difficult or extremely difficult to see blood spots.
Yeah, that makes sense to me, except that surely if you had been representing somebody and you knew that there was no blood found at the time there's a search made for blood, and then 48 hours or a month later there's blood found, you would be making a motion at least to look into whether there could have been contamination of that garment at the jail. You'd want to know that. You want to make sure the blood was there when he went in, just like it was there when the garments left. And none of that gets looked into because the lawyer hasn't bothered to read the record. That's
yes.
The problem. I mean, if you may exactly be right, the blood may have been there, they may have missed it. I couldn't say.
Petitioner could just as easily make the argument the blood could have appeared just before the murders or any time before the murders. We don't
but
know
that's
when
not the argument he is making. He is making the argument that it wasn't there. That we're going to take that first search as reliable. There's no blood when he enters the jail. Now, as you point out, maybe they just missed it. I don't know. But a good lawyer would have at least investigated that.
And we don't discuss, we don't contest the deficient performance here. But the jury knew the blood.
You don't discuss either the 45 days that it took for them to examine the blood. To do the test on the blood. Do you have any explanation for it?
No.
Is it just the carelessness?
The 45 days
yes.
to examine the blood?
Yes.
It's just the time it takes for the Indiana State Police at that time to get around, I mean, large caseload. That's the only explanation that I can, I mean, they are extremely overburdened.
The police department itself didn't have a crime lab.
I'm sorry?
The Gary Police Department didn't have a crime lab.
No. To my knowledge, the Marion County, Indianapolis is the only police department that have an independent crime lab, the only one with enough funding to establish
one. So they have to rely on the state police.
They do, and purely at their mercy. But also there's the serologist testified, there's really the time involved and even the packaging
I
did not undermine her confidence in the fact that it was a blood type.
But that's an explanation that you should be giving to the court.
And I apologize for not giving that sooner, Your Honor. The testing is accurate. Petitioner has not presented any testing that shows that it's not accurate. And the facts surrounding the discovery of the blood, except for the fact that it was not, that the petitioner was in the jail for 48 hours, approximately, before the clothing was taken from him and sent to the crime lab. That is the only fact that the jury really didn't have before them, and the sentencing judge, whenever determining petitioner's sentence. And it is just as likely that it occurred before or it occurred after.
Just to speculate that nothing happened in the jail.
And speculation, Your Honor, is all that petitioner can, that's all that we have.
Well, he has more. He has a finding of no blood when he comes in and blood when he leaves.
The evidence technician that testified that he didn't see the blood was looking from 2 or 3 feet away and looked for blood. The blood they found on Mr. Rouser, he was wearing white. It was obvious. It wasn't, respectfully, a very close analysis for whether or not he had blood. A mistake the police officer should not have made. But it is not a reliable finding that there wasn't any blood on him. The trial court said he wouldn't be able to have seen the blood from 2 or 3, the post-conviction court said he wouldn't have been able to see it. So respectfully, that has little weight. To the extent the blood evidence is compelling towards a different result in sentencing or at the guilt phase, there's no substantial evidence to show, to undermine the reliability in that determination that petitioner has been able to do, to show. At post-conviction, they just were not able to come up with experts. Even if trial counsel had noticed the blood evidence had been destroyed in the serology testing. Perhaps it should not have been, but counsel wouldn't have been able to do anything with it. So even if counsel had noticed the blood evidence, the best he could have done was cross-examine a little better and made a different argument, although frankly, I don't know what argument, and petitioner is not able to suggest another argument that they could have made. the blood evidence is not a compelling reason to undermine the reliability of the verdict. And if the court has no further questions, we ask that you affirm the denial of habeas relief in for petitioner Rouse.
Thank you, counsel.
Petitioner Williams, apologies.
Interestingly, at this point, the Attorney General wants to come in now and talk about their theory, apparently, how one defendant shot one victim, the other defendant shot the other victim, and how the blood evidence isn't important. But let's go back when this case started, and the state's theory was, and they told the jury, we don't know, we can't necessarily prove to you who the shooters are. And was the blood evidence important? Certainly the blood evidence was important. Judge Wood, as you realize, by putting that blood evidence on the petitioner, that got him the death penalty. And now the state is turning everything around and taking a different position to try and support their case here, going so far as to basically say that the crime lab technician was incompetent. There was a hearing on post-conviction review. The facts are laid out in the record. That crime lab technician testified to exactly what he did, and it wasn't only him. A number of people said there was no blood on the petitioner's shorts at that
time.
Who
are the other number? Give us their names, will you?
I don't know the names offhand, but there were Gary detectives who looked at the petitioner.
What are the names, officers? You know, it's easy to make accusations and suppositions. Who are these other people that you're referring to?
The Gary police detectives.
Who?
We can check
this record. Post-conviction record?
They all testified at the post-conviction record.
Okay, so the names appear in the post-conviction record.
Yes. The one thing I want to correct, too, is it's not just a matter of taking the clothes 48 hours later and then sending them to the crime lab. The time, it was 30 to 45 days that this evidence was held at the prosecutor's office. Not only do you have the evidence, but we all have to realize that there are blood, tubes of blood that are taken as standards from the victim, from Rouster. The 45% of the population that that blood could have originated from was also from Rouster. We don't know what happened in 30 to 45 days when it sat in the prosecutor's office. That's why we asked for the discovery. That's why we asked for the DNA testing. The DNA testing nowadays is going to tell us if it's Rouster's, if it's one of the victims. Or
what do you make of the 30 caliber cartridges?
Clearly they were not any of the bullets used to kill the victims. The evidence will show, I believe, in the record that one of those guns belonged to the victims. That was in the house. The other weapon was brought, and I believe the record is clear that the other weapon was brought for Rouster. I'll admit the evidence is, it was probably passed back and forth between Rouster and the petitioner. But one gun was brought, one gun was inside the residence, and if there's a 30 caliber bullet on the petitioner and he took that bullet, I'm not going to stand up here again, Judge Wood, as you realize, and say that this man is actually innocent of murder. The Indiana Supreme Court found and affirmed the conviction. Our question or our thrust here is to say this death penalty is inappropriate. The reason why it's inappropriate is because the way that the state actually relied on the blood evidence after the co-defendant's attorney started the ball rolling.
Well, how did the 30 caliber cartridge get in the, I think it was the bedroom where the shooting occurred?
All I can offer is presumption that the victims, the Reeses, had 30 caliber bullets in their premises. Or maybe the petitioner had a couple of 30 caliber bullets in his pocket and dropped one. Or maybe Rouster had 30 caliber bullets in his pocket and dropped one. Clearly there's some like trace evidence, a transfer of something there, but we don't know. It was never proven, and I can't say anything more than conjecture either, presumption. It shows some linking of the petitioner being there, but that's it. And that also doesn't warrant giving him the death penalty.
There seems to be a cumulative effect of some of these things, like the presence of the cartridge in the room where the murders occurred. And he had one on him.
But it still doesn't show that he actually committed one of the murders and warranted the death penalty. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel. We will take the case under advisement. Court is adjourned.